Welcome. Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is John Cozy. John, it's great having you back again. And so often you write an article that just ties right into some of the stuff that I'm thinking about, and I'm certainly thinking about what you wrote about in what I guess is your most recent article. You sent it to me some days ago, and you call it Sanctions, Wars, and Assassinations. Sounds like official U.S. policy, John.
Well, that's what it is.
Indeed it is. I want to let you jump right into your article, but can I mention one thing before we get off in it?
Sure.
Press TV had me on just a little while ago discussing the, a couple of hundred children were evacuated from eastern Ukraine into Crimea. They were very lucky to cross the border. That was the topic that I was asked to discuss. I mentioned that my thought was, to get out of Ukraine, to go anywhere, you're going to Crimea, you're going into Russia. Crimea is Russian territory now. You need to get past the Ukrainian border guards. They can easily stop these people if they want to. They can give them a very bad time, but they let them through, and I considered it a publicity stunt. You know, let a couple of hundred kids go out and make it look like, these fascists that are running things in Ukraine are really aren't such bad guys. Well, they're worse than bad guys. But a very interesting development came up in the last few days, I believe, and I'm writing about it for an article for tomorrow, and I concentrated most of my comments on Press TV explaining it. The nonviolent Maidan protesters in Kiev, the ones that began protesting last November and continued doing it with the violent protesters right through the February 22nd coup, these people never left Independence Square. The Maidan, or the Euromaidan, as it's sometimes called, they're still there. And today, I'm not certain if it's still going on, but it was an hour or two or three ago, there was a mass rally in Independence Square on the Maidan or the Euromaidan, and a lot of these people, these nonviolent protesters, are not happy about what they see going on in Ukraine right now. They wrote a manifesto, and they had four basic principles in it. It basically came down to these people want to see something happened, something along the lines of real democracy, which is what they were protesting nonviolently about, aside from the violent protesters. But in their words, they haven't seen it yet. They haven't seen it yet. And they said, we're not leaving until we do see it. So the struggle for Ukraine's soul continues, John, and I think this is a marvelous development. There were thousands of these people out today on the information that I got, and I mean, if they're there and they're not going away, it'll be very interesting to see what happens going forward. Well, it's in my article I'm writing for tomorrow. I'll certainly be following this. I don't expect the major media to be reporting about this, certainly not accurately, but it shows that maybe the Western Ukrainians can become just as activist as the Eastern Ukrainians, and if that's the case, and if this thing grows in strength, I think this is a marvelous development.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised it's happening because In one of my recent papers, I quoted some of the people that were in Kiev, and they made it clear that they weren't leaving until something substantial happened. And then, of course, you know, they went off the air, mainly because nobody wanted to know what they wanted. So I'm not surprised in that. One of the themes I've written about a couple of times recently is that anybody can demonstrate. If your guys can get together, go out on the street and demonstrate, somebody else's guys can get together and go out and demonstrate. And that's a road to nowhere. Because that can go on and on and on until everybody is just defeat. I wasn't a bit surprised when the people in eastern Ukraine began to demonstrate and to take over buildings and things, because that was what they did in western Ukraine. I mean, it's easy. I even quoted a song that you you commented on. I mean, anything you can do, I can do better. You know, I mean that's how obvious it is, and that's what democracy has become today. You hold an election, the people who lose don't like the election they demonstrate. Okay? And then, you know, depending on how they demonstrate, something happens. Like in Egypt, the government, the army took over. In other places, other things happen. But that's what happens when you claim to be an advocate of democracy but are quite willing to resort to authoritative street demonstrations to get your point across.
Well, there were two types of protesters in western Ukraine, in Kiev mainly. I think some other cities, Lviv or Lvov, I think I've seen it spelled both two ways, protests against the Yanukovych, the sitting government, the democratically elected government. And to me, if you don't like the democratically elected government, and there was plenty to dislike about Yanukovych, but he was the president in 2004. He was ousted by the first Orange Revolution. The Ukrainians reelected him in 2010. There was another election scheduled for next year or early 2016, I forget which. If they didn't like the guy, they could have voted him out of office then. But there were two types of protesters in Kiev. The nonviolent ones were the majority, and the violent ones were the minority, and they were literally paid and enlisted and trained to commit violence. The worst of them, these neo-Nazi thugs, they literally were trained to commit violence. They were taken abroad, I believe, to Lithuania and to Poland, and given instructions by Western people, maybe CIA, maybe U.S. Special Forces, on committing violence, and they were the ones totally responsible for killing over 100 people, blamed wrongfully on the Yanukovych government. He had nothing whatsoever to do with it. The police, the special police, the Berkut, showed remarkable restraint. They had one bad day. They had one bad day early in the game last year, and aside from that one bad day, Yanukovych was furious. And he really called them down, and they went beyond remarkable restraint. They were too restrained, because police are supposed to enforce law and order and get rid of the violence, and they basically stood by and did too little. So let all this stuff happen. But the nonviolent protesters, they were legitimate. There were plenty of griefs to complain about against the Yanukovych government. I mean, a neoliberal government supporting the oligarchs, making them richer, keeping the Ukrainians poor. What kind of a government is that? So the complaints...
Well, it's the kind we have.
The kind we have, exactly, John.
I mean, you know, well, you know, that's the trouble with street revolutions. They're never consist of... just one group of people. I mean, they attract all sorts of people who are anti the government, who may not agree with each other, but they agree with each other in being anti government. And I mean, that's what happened in Egypt, and that's what happened in Tunisia, and you know, it's not surprising that it happened in the Ukraine. That's the trouble with demonstrations. You can't control who's involved, what you say is no doubt accurate, but it's inevitable. That kind of thing is inevitable.
Yeah, it really is, John. And I think an easy rule of thumb for anybody to follow is that whatever side Washington supports, you can bet. You can bet, a sure bet, that they're the bad guys, and the ones that Washington is against, you can bet they're the good guys. And that was, well, relatively speaking, of course, that was the situation in Ukraine. You mentioned Egypt. Well, we had a phony election in Ukraine. We had a phony election in Egypt, almost on the same date. Egypt's ran 3 days, 3 days, because nobody showed up to vote.
it's just what authoritarian minds do when things get tough. I mean, it's always the stirrup trouble, distrust, hatred, start killing, and who's ever left standing when the killing is done, he wins. You know, I mean, it's not. It's an old rule of thumb that they follow. I don't. You know, I said in the paper I wrote for that book that we all took part in.
Oh yes, Flashpoint in Ukraine. You were one of the major contributors.
Yeah, I wrote in that book. It'll take years. It'll take years for the troubles of Ukraine to be ironed out.
Indeed.
They're not going to get ironed out, and it doesn't matter if they have an election or not. The same old people are running for office. They're not going to change. The new president, I don't know, maybe he'll get peace by handing out chocolates. I mean, you know, who knows what he'll do.
Poroshenko, but, the oligarch Poroshenko, I call him a mega crook, and he is a mega crook.
How anybody thought that, a billionaire elected president of Ukraine was going to solve problems beats the heck out of me. I mean, he didn't get that. He didn't get that billion in honest activity.
No, he sure didn't. There really were no choices on the ballot, John. You know, you could get the oligarch Poroshenko. You could get this mega crook Yulia Tymoshenko. Some of these names are tough, but after I see them and read them and write them so many times, I remember some of them. But the ones I don't write about very much, I have to keep checking, and you got to check the spelling. It's very easy to make a mistake. Well, she came in second with about, 8 or 9% of the vote, and Poroshenko got about 54%. The Ukrainians just sort of stayed home and voted for nobody. I mean, why vote for anybody? All of the people who were allowed to run for the presidency were vetted by the fascist regime, so there wasn't a Democrat in the whole lineup.
But isn't that what happens here in America?
Exactly the same thing, except you don't have 20 people running. You have two main ones. You know, the two parties.
But, I mean, you know, that's the rule of thumb in Western democracy these days. I mean,
indeed.
The shadow government picks the candidates. Picks candidates that they know will do their bidding, and they're presented to the people, and the people are fooled into thinking that they're electing somebody.
Same thing in Europe, John, and in too many other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all over the case. So, you know, I don't know what to say about that. The dumb part was that the demonstrators in Lvov or Kiev in the first place. Then nobody ever thinks through what is going to happen if we succeed. I mean, nobody asks that question. All I care about is succeeding. Oh boy, we got rid of the president. Yeah, okay, and look what you got in return. But that's the way people are. They're not thoughtful, and they never sit down to think carefully about what they're doing.
They're very naive, and they think that if they throw out bums, they're going to get something better. But all they do in America and in most European countries is they get new bums. And it's the occasional exception, John, that proves the rule. Venezuela was a huge exception. And the only reason Chavez was allowed to even run in 1998 was that the powers that be in Venezuela thought that whatever changes he might want to bring, they could basically control him. So it really wouldn't be too bad. So in other words, throw the population a bone and make them feel better, but we'll still keep our hands. They felt they'll still keep their hands on power. And they didn't realize that they really had a tiger by the tail, and Chavez was not going to play that game, and he really was a true Democrat, but he was the exception that proves the rule, and they wanted to get rid of him. Certainly Washington wanted to get rid of him. They tried a few times, short of killing him, and then Obama ended up killing him, I'm absolutely convinced, when he came down with cancer and getting the best medical care in the world. And in 18 months, four major surgeries couldn't save him, and he died in his 50s, a great, great tragedy. and now the new president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, is being targeted, and literally he is targeted, and he believes that he's a target for death. And I write occasionally about Venezuela. I've got a new article I wrote this morning on Venezuela. I'll get it out tomorrow, combining the Congress, the House passing sanctions, a Senate committee passing sanctions against Venezuela, which means the whole Senate, overwhelmingly a Foreign Relations Committee, I think voted 13-2 for sanctions against Venezuela. Lawless sanctions, no legitimacy whatever, and the full Senate will vote on this whenever they get around to it and pass sanctions. They're meaningless, they'll do absolutely nothing, but they're illegal, they're counterproductive. You take a model democracy like Venezuela and you slam the hell out of them, and Maduro thinks he absolutely is a target for assassination. And I think he's right, and these protests that have been going on since February, Washington manipulated, 40-odd people have been killed, many others have been injured. Regime change, the same old regime change scheme, John. You know, if you don't have a government in your pocket, in Washington's pocket, the government gets targeted for regime change. It can either be a war, it can be an assassination, it can be anything. It's the same dirty game that just keeps being repeated over and over again. So you got Ukraine targeted, and you got Venezuela targeted at the same time, and of course you got the war in Syria going on.
I mean. The fact that American foreign policy has been, ever since the end of the Second World War, its goal has been regime change, to get every government in the world compliant with American desires. That's pretty obvious to anybody who knows what's going on. That's something I don't even want to bother writing about anymore. I mean, it's an obvious truth, I'd like to, and I can't figure this out. I really can't. I'd like to understand why people around the world don't realize that this is going on and quit being puppy dogs to the American bitch. I mean, that's what I don't understand. I don't understand it at all. I don't understand why what the United States calls terrorists are hell bent on killing Americans on, I don't know, Americans in America or Americans on airplanes or whatever, when they could be all over this whole world killing American businessmen over there trying to do business. And they could tie up American economy in knots. And they don't do it. They want to do something flashy, like knock down the World Trade Center or whatever. If they did, I don't know that they did, but that's the kind of thing that I understand. I just don't understand. I don't understand how the people of Great Britain or France or Germany could follow America's lead in all of this, except that their governments are now going back into Africa trying to redo colonization. I mean, they're cut from the same cloth as American politicians, but I don't know why the people don't see that. I just don't understand the stupidity. I mean, if you're going to fight a war, fight it in a way that you can win battles, not lose them.
John, when I take a break for a meal, lunch, or something, I like to check what's on corporate news media, the cable channels, just at the top of the hour, to check what they're broadcasting, what they're talking about. And if you take a look at that, and I just flip quickly from one to the other, including I get BBC, I get Al Jazeera America, just to see what they're reporting. And if you see the directions they're going, you can understand how people are completely kept in the dark. They just don't know what's going on. They either have a story unrelated to major geopolitical events, wars or other major events, or if they're covering something like Ukraine, they literally report things upside down. You know, the good guys are portrayed as the bad guys, and the bad guys as the good guys. So, I mean, the propaganda machine is in high gear, and people who pay attention to this, who go to these sources for what they call news and information, I mean, they end up knowing nothing. I mean, they literally...
Yeah, I agree with you, but what I don't understand is why the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or, you know, any affiliate is taken in by that kind of stuff.
Oh, they're not taken in.
And then I don't understand why they're using tactics like they are.
The Taliban?
You know, there are a lot of things I don't understand. I mean, the world gets upset about Boko Haram kidnapping some women in Nigeria, which is okay. There's nothing wrong with being upset about that. But nobody says anything about two little girls getting raped in India and hung from a tree. Hmm. Nobody says anything about it. I mean, what the hell? The Indian women, you know, it's okay to kill them, but it's not okay to kidnap Nigerian women? I mean, I just don't understand, you know, how you can equate, in a sense. Well, what happens in America, or, you know, happens in America? We talk a lot about, you know, the way women are treated in the rest of the world, but American women aren't treated all that well. I mean, why don't we, you know, realize that?
Oh, they sure aren't treated well, John. It's been a good while, but I've written a few times about America's culture of violence, and one of the things I remember writing about is calling America a rape culture. Astonishing. With the raping of women is so extensive, usually by somebody, not by a stranger most of the time, by somebody they know, either a friend or more likely a family member. Just absolutely astonishing, the stuff that goes on. And as far as violence causing death, my God, America is a gun society, and I've written plenty about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we all know that. But what I don't understand is, you know, here we have we're cozying up to India, this great advancing country or developing country that we want to have all kinds of relationships with, and their women are being gang raped in the streets and killed. And nobody's saying anything about it, but oh boy, Boko Haram kidnaps some women that it wants to sell, not kill, but sell, and oh boy, there's an uproar. I mean, it's nonsense.
It makes for good headlines here, John. You know,
it makes for good headlines.
It makes it look like America really cares about this.
I mean,
stuff.
Where are the sanctions against India for their, you know, for their treatment of a non-existent but still existent caste system? The policies of the Western world, America and Europe especially, are so hypocritical that it's hard to understand why the rest of the non-Western nations don't understand this. I don't know how anybody could take it, frankly.
I write a little bit about some of these countries. I wrote about the Indian election, which it's a bit outrageous to call India the world's largest democracy, because the system is just like America's, more or less. You get two dominant parties. You get more than two, but really two dominant parties. And actually, one of them came in third, not second, so it wasn't so dominant this time. The ruling party, the Congress party that was ruling in the BJP, took its place, winning the election with this guy Modi becoming the new prime minister. Well, I mean, this guy is about as anti-populist as you can can get. And the people of India, the desperate people, the poor people, they're not going to get anything from this guy. And the only thing America wants is an ally to use against its enemies, namely Russia and China. And India, of course, is a very important country, very large country, growing economy. So America very much wants India on its side for geopolitical reasons, also for a market for U.S. products, military ones, other ones. So this is part of the dirty game. And same with Pakistan. Pakistan is a smaller country. And this stuff just goes on all the time. But as far as democracy in these countries, I look around the world, John. I don't see very much in the way of democracy. There are very few countries in the world I would call truly democratic, and the only one I consider a model democracy, as close to a model as possible, not perfect, but as close to a model as possible, is Venezuela, and that's the reason Venezuela is in Washington's gun sights for regime change, and I'll be watching things very closely to see what happens ahead. But we've had a lot of stuff going on there for a number of months, wrongfully blamed on the sitting government, the Maduro government, and it could get worse. It could get a lot worse. There was an aborted coup in 2002, and there was a lot of stuff, a lot of strife that took place after that. But some important elements of Venezuelan society has never gone along with this, including the heart and soul of Venezuela's military. And as long as that stays on the side of the sitting government, there's no chance in the world that there'll be regime change. And the great majority of Venezuelans, unlike the situation in Ukraine, the great majority of Venezuelans support the Venezuelan government. So they're not in the streets demanding regime change. And the violence is very much restricted to middle income and upscale areas, and a fairly small number of them, where if you were in Venezuela and you went to the barrios or the poor areas, you wouldn't see any violence. And if you ask people what they thought about the government, you'd find that the support for the Maduro government was overwhelming. But you'd never see those kind of reports in America's media.
No, you never will. The truth is that the American news media, popular press, as it's called, is a business. It feeds customers what they want to hear, what they think they want to hear. Anyhow, they're not. The news is the news stations aren't interested in presenting any news. They're interested in attracting viewers so that they can sell their demographics to advertisers. I mean, that's all it's all about.
Exactly.
I don't know why. I don't know. It's always been that way. It's not anything new. The American news media have never been interested in news. Never.
Oh, absolutely, John. I forget. I think a media activist by the name of Gerbner, I forget his first name, Gerbner, one of his great quotes was, the major media has everything to sell and nothing to tell.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a nice line. And that's true. I mean, the absurdity of it all is so obvious to anybody with a brain. You're watching a show, say, on American fraud. You know, this NBC has a series of American Greed or something it's called, and they tell a story about some major fraudster that they caught up with and put in jail. But you know, this American fraud, you know how it's you know who pays for the show?
No.
Fraudulent snake oil salesman.
I don't watch much television, John. I'm too busy writing and doing other things. So, except that I just catch a glimpse of the news to see the direction these people are going in. But you could name all of these primetime programs. I swear to God, I've never seen one of them.
Well, I don't watch many of them either, but people in the house do. So.
Oh, they do. Absolutely. We're going to take a break very shortly. I think my favorite media quote came from the former comedian Ernie Kovacs. You remember him?
Yep.
Back in the 1960s.
Yep.
He said he knew why television was called a medium, because it's neither rare or well done. Isn't that a great line?
Yeah.
We're gonna take a break, John. Let's do that, and then we'll come back and we'll pick it right up again. We're back. My guest is John Cozy. John, there's so much going on, the Ukraine situation, the war in Syria. We mentioned Venezuela. There's so much else. I wonder how many listeners, I've mentioned it on this program, how many listeners realize that U.S. Special Forces, these are people who are literally trained to be expert killers. They operate in over 120 countries worldwide. You could throw a dot at a map, and you'd no doubt hit a country where U.S. Special Forces operate, and they don't come as goodwill ambassadors. They come to practice their stock and trade and do it covertly. And as far as CIA people go, they're everywhere. They infest every country. They usually operate out of U.S. embassies. And you get FBI operatives. They're only supposed to operate domestically, and CIA are only supposed to operate abroad, but both of them operate globally. Doesn't matter. The lines are blurred. Globally means domestically, abroad, anywhere. So the CIA can operate in America just the way the FBI does, and the FBI abroad the same way as the CIA does. And it's ugly, ugly stuff, plus all the spying that NSA does. There's no question they spy on me. I'm sure they spy on you, John. But we make it easy. The stuff that we do out in the open. So they don't need to spy on us. Just read our articles, listen to my radio program, listen to you when you come on. They'll know everything they need to know about us. I mean, we're straightforward. We tell it the way it needs to be told. And they know us, but they do this stuff. And I have no doubt that they keep a close eye on what I do. Maybe they'll buy my book. And your book, John.
Yeah, okay. Well, they don't buy anything of mine.
Well, you were a valued contributor to the book. I'll mention the title again, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. The book is out, John. Have you gotten your copy yet?
Nope.
You should pretty soon. I have not gotten mine either.
Where was it sent?
Did you send your address to Clarity Publishing?
No, I never asked for that.
I asked you to.
Oh, well, I never did.
Oh. When we get off here, I'll send you the email address to send it. No, I emailed everybody, and I said, please send your name and address to Clarity Press and their editor, Diana Collier, who I work closely with, and she'll mail the book out. Well, the book up to now has only been available in print on demand, and how this works exactly, I don't know, but it'll go into mass distribution, I believe, as of today. Today is the 1st of June. Let's call it Monday. Into mass distribution, and Diana told me I'll be getting my copies, early June, maybe in a few days. So I'll be getting them very shortly. And everybody else will. I don't know who's gotten them or who hasn't gotten them, but they will be going out rather than print on demand for the contributors. Get it into mass distribution, and then people will get copies of the book. I do know, and one of the contributors told me, I don't know why he did this, he said he went out and bought two copies. This was a couple of weeks ago. He bought them through Amazon, and he got immediate delivery. I think immediate, you know, the way Amazon confirms an order, you put the order in and they give you a delivery date. And I think his delivery date was a couple of days after he ordered it. So I'm certain that he got his book right away. So apparently you could go to Amazon 2 weeks ago and get very, very quick delivery on the book. And they're offering an obscene discount. Not... I don't know why they're offering such a big discount. I mean, the book is really a treasure, and they should have offered a modest discount, as they usually do, which is fine. And if I buy a book on Amazon, I appreciate getting a discount. But they offered an enormous discount. I understand the book is selling pretty well, John.
Well, that's interesting, because I don't know anything about it.
I check every now and then, and I'll see what's going on. We're still looking I thought we had a Chinese publisher all locked up, but apparently not so. But I'm hoping that will happen. And the one I really would like to get is a Russian publisher. This is such a slam dunk book for a Russian publisher. It'll be a shame if it isn't published in Russian. I mean, a Russian language edition.
Wait, a Ukrainian publisher.
Well, I don't think anybody in Ukraine is going to publish this book. But I would think Russia would really want to publish this book, and the people that I know in Russia at RT International, at Voice of Russia, RAIN Novosti, I just call them RAIN, I'm in contact with these people. They've interviewed me. I've mentioned all of this to them, including a Russian TV program. I had their host on my program. He's supposed to invite me on his program. I haven't gotten the invitation yet. I mentioned to him we're looking for a Russian publisher, and I'll really be surprised if we don't get one, because I think this book would really be a bestseller in Russia, a nonfiction bestseller. It's very pro-Russian. I mean, we're not pro-Russian, John, because we support Russia. We support the truth, and your chapter certainly went in that direction. The ones that I wrote went in that direction. The entire book went in that direction. Really marvelous information, each chapter not overlapping others, and so many vital topics discussed by marvelous contributors like you, John. I mean, all of you, 22 contributors, including myself, and that's what really made the book. And we got it out in record time, John, from scratch. From the day I heard about it and was asked to serve as editor, we got this book out in 2 months. I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It took a little mother henning on my part.
At any rate, send me that email, and I'll...
Oh, I will. I absolutely will. As soon as the program is over, I'll send you Diana's email. Very simple, and she'll get you the book. You haven't missed anything, because the copies may not have gotten out yet, and they probably will early next week. So you will not have missed a beat, and you'll get it. You'll get your copy. Everybody gets a copy.
Okay.
My God, that's the least we could do for you, John. I mean, nobody's making any money on this. I hope Clarity makes some money on this, because it's the only way they can stay in business and put out other good books like this. Clarity Press, they publish marvelous books, important topics, marvelous contributors. I know some of them. Francis Boyle, international law professor, human rights law professor, James Petras. Both of them come on my program, Petras more often than Francis Boyle. I have a hard time pinning him down, but I know both of them very well, and Clarity has published a number of their books, and others, marvelous books. Mani Nazim Roya, he was a contributor. Clarity has published at least one of his books. They published two of mine, well, three of mine now, and I hope to do more. I've got a follow-up book in mind, and I hope I'll get a chance to do it maybe early next year, and even another topic after that. I'd love to do a book on political prisons in America, John. My editor, Diana, she liked the topic, and I broached that to her some time ago. She liked it, and she put it to her editorial board, and they turned it down, thinking it might not sell well enough. Well, I'm going to go back and broach that subject again. I mean, I could write a very long book on political activists who've been wrongly targeted in America and became political prisoners, and I know a few personally, friends of mine, who are political prisoners, who should have had statues built to them, not put in prison for things they never did. But this is the way America is run, and just marvelous. I could include people outside of the country, including in Canada, and another one of my regular guests, Denny Rancourt. I had a program featuring Denny that I did by myself, and I repeated it because I had a conflict and I couldn't go live on Friday. I repeated the program. It's in my archives on Denny supporting him, going up against a corrupted system in Canada where he was drummed out of the University of Ottawa for doing what, John? For supporting Palestinian rights, and then being sued unjustifiably for, of all people, a human rights lawyer, a human rights professor, I'm sorry, a human rights professor at the University of Ottawa, accusing Denny wrongfully of racism because he quoted Malcolm X referring to this woman as a house Negro, which is exactly what she is, for supporting the criminal policies of the university run by a former political hack, a political hack literally, and a fascist, and this is the guy, Alan Rock is his name, the president of the University of Ottawa, and he knows who I am, John. Denny told me he knows who I am. I've written several times about Denny. I included Alan Rock in my articles, and this guy knows who I am. And I just wrote another article about Denny just 2 or 3 weeks or so ago, and I'm sure he spotted it. I'm sure he read it. I'm sure that, oh, there goes Lenman again. And I'm sure he wasn't happy. What's he going to do, sue me? Who knows?
Well, I don't know. I read about Bloomberg's speech to Harvard.
Oh, I haven't read his speech. I wrote about Bloomberg. I don't want to interrupt you, John, but I wrote about Bloomberg at Harvard. But what did he say? What did he say?
Well, he was talking about liberal professors attacking conservative ideas.
What liberal professors?
Yeah, what conservative ideas? There's never been a conservative idea. it's the kind of thing. People believe. I shouldn't use that word, think. People believe that our political system is divided into basically two groups. Called liberals and conservatives, but it isn't. It never has been. There has never been a liberal party in the United States of America. Never. If what passes the liberal party becomes popular, if you turn it over, you'll find a bunch of guys just trying to preserve the capitalist system. I was on a program with Tom Kiley, INN News Radio or something.
Oh yes, I know him.
We were talking about Roosevelt and a chicken in every pot, and I said, yeah, he wanted a chicken in every pot so people like he could continue eating Chateaubriand.
Indeed.
I mean, the New Deal was a New Deal, okay, but it wasn't a New Deal for people. It was a New Deal for capitalism. And so we have that in this country. It's trying to extirpate it from this society is I think, impossible, fruitless. The only way you can get capitalism out of America is to have capitalism collapse, which it may very well be doing. But
it may someday, John. Indeed, so. I mean, it's what Roosevelt did with the New Deal. I mean, I'd certainly take Roosevelt over over anybody who followed him. But basically, the country was in dire shape in the 30s, and he gave a little to save a lot. The New Deal was a program to save capitalism, because capitalism could have been destroyed then. There was so much public anger about the pain going on, so that he literally created policies to keep the lid on, and that was the whole idea behind the New Deal. But at least we had it. We had something. We got Social Security, which was marvelous. Didn't get Medicare. Should have gotten Medicare right then, but he didn't do that. But we did get Social Security, and that was the greatest poverty. It's been the greatest poverty reducer for elderly people. A marvelous program, and it gave nothing when it began, but it built into an important system. It should be a lot better than it is. By the way, when I wrote about Bloomberg at Harvard, I said in my article, I mean, the guy is a multi-billionaire. He's worth about $16, $17, $18 billion. I said maybe he'll end up running Harvard one day, and if he does, he'll run it like New York City, maybe he'll become president of Harvard one day and run it like New York City. And then my last line was something like, maybe he'll order it privatized and buy it.
Yeah, that's possible, that is New York City. Harvard is privatized.
to a great extent. It absolutely is. And these are the kind of people I invite back to be their speakers. In 1956, John, Jack Kennedy was my commencement speaker. He was only a junior senator from Massachusetts, but I went back and I read his speech, and it was so marvelous. I've mentioned it on this program. I wrote about it, and I mentioned it again in a couple of subsequent articles, but it was a marvelous speech that Kennedy gave. It was the kind of things that the politicians don't talk about these days. Very erudite, something worth listening to a politician say. And when I was there, I mean, that was in 1956. It was so long ago. I don't remember a thing about what he said, but when I went back years later and read his speech, I was so impressed by it, I felt I wanted to write about it, including his policies as president, where he came in as a cold warrior, and he transformed himself in fairly short order into a peacemaker, and that was the reason he was assassinated. It had nothing to do with Lee Harvey Oswald, this garbage that the media puts out. Absolutely had nothing to do with him.
You know, You know, I've said this for years, and I don't know why Americans other Americans don't realize it or don't say it. Every time something happens that's really bad in America, like the blowing up of the building in Oklahoma City, or you know, Waco, Texas, or the assassinations of presidents, or Martin Luther King or something, even 9/11, we always put together a political commission to study, investigate the matter. Now, you know, our general, even, you know, the general view of politicians in this country, if you talk to a guy on the street, is that they're crooked. So, you know, when you have something like 9/11 happen and you appoint a political commission to study it, and the people think the politicians are crooked, I mean, how are you ever going to get, you know, an honest investigation out of that kind of thing? It's not ever going to happen. You know, take the VA, all the troubles with it today. They've existed a long time. I gave up trying to use the VA in Dallas because it was impossible. But you know what's going to happen? They're gonna name a political commission to study it, I'm sure.
Oh, I know what's going to happen, John.
And 10 years from now, nothing will happen.
I think
it's as bad as it is now.
I think what they're going to do is try to privatize it.
Well, I mean, that's all right. It can't be any worse.
It can't be any worse than it is now. I've used the VA. I haven't used it in years. I guess you're a veteran, John. I'm a veteran, 1950s for me. And I could go to the VA for medical care. I went for prescription drugs the few times I ever needed anything. I really needed anything, but I went there a couple of times for prescription drugs. They make it so hard for you to get something, and the choices are restricted, and you need to see a doctor every time. You can't just walk in with a prescription from your private physician and get it filled. You need to see one of theirs who is a resident. I saw several of them. I mean, nice guys or young women, very nice people. They're doing their jobs, but really a terrible system. But just seeing the people who rely on the VA, and most of them are there because they have no other place to go. So as rotten as the service is abominable. It takes an awful long time to get an appointment, and the people you talk to, as I recall, were very callous in dealing with you. You know, I mean, they're robots. You know, they answer so many calls a day and give out so much information.
Steve,
and they don't care, John. They just don't care.
I wrote a paper a long time ago. I think it's called Veterans Day or something like that. And I pointed out that Veterans Day, a day set aside presumably to honor veterans, is very interesting. Government employees and bankers get the day off, but veterans with jobs have to work. I mean, you know, that's how you honor veterans in America. I mean, it's not, there's nothing new about it. It goes way back. You know what happened to the to the veterans who protested in Washington, World War One veterans who protested in Washington, and the MacArthur drove them out of the mall or whatever.
Oh, indeed, Douglas MacArthur.
You know, people think somehow or other that this is different than it was. It's not. It's the same thing as it's always been. The veterans in veterans hospitals have been treated almost entirely like American Indians on reservations. I mean that's simply the way it is. I mean, but my point was that, you know, we always have some political group do these investigations, and the politicians are the ones who created the situation in the first place. So they you know, get a political group together to create to investigate, and of course nothing happens ever. It's always washed under the rug, or swept under the rug. That's a bad metaphor. But you know, and another thing about it's always bothered me. You know, we have in every police force in this country, in any city, there is a long list of unsolved cases, especially murders. But official murder takes place, and boy, we not only know who did it within hours, we catch them. Is that ever sound strange to you?
Yeah, very strange, John, indeed.
How in the world, in the city of Dallas, were they able to find Lee Harvey Oswald in a movie theater, you know, within hours of the killing?
If you couldn't smell a rat by that.
One policeman found him. I mean, you know, that's incredible.
Sirhan, or James Earl Ray.
Yeah, all of them. The guy who bombed the building in Oklahoma City, he's driving down the road in the car without a license plate and stopped and arrested. I mean, come on now.
It's been a while since I wrote about Oklahoma City, John, but that was an inside job, and these two young men, I forget their names offhand, I don't think it was not a car bomb that took down the Murrow building. Yeah, the building was wired on the inside, and that's it. It not only blew up the building, it blew up a damaged building over, oh my goodness, maybe over a 12-block circumference around the Murrow building, and a study was done at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base by an expert in demolitions, and he wrote about it. Several months later, he came up with the conclusions of the Oklahoma City bombing and concluded it had nothing to do with a truck bomb. So these guys were framed. They had nothing to do with it.
But my point is, you know, that this kind of thing happens over and over and over and over again, and nobody raises any questions about it.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
How when these police forces throughout the nation can't find ordinary citizens who are killers, they can find a guy who killed a politician in minutes? I mean, that's incredible.
They sure can find anybody who they've framed in advance to take the fall. And
yeah.
It's very easy to know where they are, John, if you just tail them on the day
there.
In question.
Yeah. Sure.
The 9/11 bombers with people leaving their IDs in the trunk of their car.
that's the thing about, you know, American status quo. Everybody's in on it, and the rest of us sit around and watch it happen, and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, I don't care how many articles I write. Nobody reads them.
Not enough people read them, John. You know, people read them, but not enough people. You get publicity through the major media. You can get thousands, many thousands of people paying attention to what you do. The worst kind of stuff in books, fiction and nonfiction, they become bestsellers because they get promoted by the New York Times and so on. And the good stuff, like our Flashpoint in Ukraine book, not a word in the major media, so it certainly won't become a bestseller, but it should be a bestseller. And if it ever got the publicity that the stuff that they promote gets, it would be a major nonfiction bestseller. It all depends on what these people want to do with it, but they certainly would not give us the slightest bit of publicity.
No. I mean, and then you know, so you know, when I ask myself, you know, well, why do I write these papers? Why do I, you know, put them out on Global Research or on my website or something? And the answer is, it's more to clarify my own thinking than any other reason. I mean, if I clarify my own thinking about what goes on with sanctions, wars, and assassinations, you know, I've always been as a student with the desire to know the truth. It never really occurred to me to be a rabble rouser to try to change the world. Because I don't have to change. I can't change the world. I can know the truth and tell it. But you know, if people don't want to listen to it, well, nothing you do about it.
Well, I feel a great passion to spread important truth, John, and we're just about out of time. But I hope other people will pick up the mantle or the baton and run with it, and that more people will want to know what's going on. And if enough people want this, then literally this is the only way we can change anything, because if people think we're going to change it by going to the ballot box, people who listen to this program know you can't do it. But most people don't realize that. The only way we can change things for the better is if ordinary people do it on their own. So I'm literally impassioned to want to do this, and I'm hoping I can influence other people who want to do it too, hoping that maybe one day there'll be some real change that we don't have now. John, we're just about out of time. I look forward to getting you back next month. There's always so much to talk about. This program, spreading important truths and hoping other people will pick up on them and want to tell still more people. And we've seen great changes happen in this country in the past. If it's happened before, it can happen again. It's just a matter of whether ordinary people will decide they don't want to take what's going on anymore and they intend to do something about it. And I feel my job and my mission is to try to encourage them to move in that direction. It's become my life's mission, John.
Well, there's an old saying, Stephen, the truth will set you free unless you don't know it.
Well, I give it the old college try every day, and literally I look forward to doing more every day, John. And I never imagined I'd be doing any of this, but once I got into it, to me, it's my drug of choice, John. I've become so addicted to doing this that I literally look forward every day to doing more and writing more articles, and I love media work, whether it's this program or being interviewed. It's really what I want to do every day. John, I look forward to next month. I'll shoot you an email on how to get hold of Diana Collier at the Clarity Press. Shoot her your address, and she'll send you a copy of the book.
Okay. See you, Steve.
And join us archived every Thursday and Friday. Generally the same day programs appear in my archives. And live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.